Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Rewiring Education: How Technology Can Unlock Every Student's Potential by John D. Couch, with Jason Town. Forward by Steve Wozniak. Narrated by P.J. Oglin. Forward. Having taught technology to fifth grade students, I have witnessed firsthand the excitement and engagement it can bring to the learning process. But there aren't many people I know who truly understand this phenomenon more than my longtime friend and colleague, John Couch. I first met John back in 1978, just after he was hired as Apple's 54th employee by Steve Jobs. John was brought on as our first director of new products, and was soon promoted to be our vice president of software and lead the software team that created the graphical user interface. Even back then, John had a knack for simplifying and communicating complex ideas, and today, there aren't many areas that need simplifying and fixing more than education. I can't remember a time when John wasn't passionate about education. I still remember the extraordinary stories he would tell of his time teaching at UC Berkeley and Cal State, or the decade he spent rebuilding a K-12 school in San Diego. It was no surprise to me at all then when, shortly after Steve Jobs rejoined Apple, John was brought back, this time as the company's first ever Vice President of Education. Since that time, he has been an integral part of Apple's ongoing efforts to transform education from passive traditions to active innovations. This book might well be thought of as an inside look at all John's experiences, and, in a sense, Apple's, along the way. It takes the reader from Steve Jobs's passion for education into the brains and minds of digital natives, and on to a new framework for learning that has the potential to make obsolete the consumption memorization model used today. Through personal anecdotes and the stories of real teachers, John explores new ways of learning and teaching. Last, he gives the reader a glimpse of future technologies that have the opportunity to usher in a truly personalized learning environment where every student can unlock their hidden potential and change the world. I believe that every parent, teacher, principal, politician, activist, innovator, and leader who is responsible for and/or passionate about teaching, learning, or training in any capacity will benefit greatly from reading this book. Steve Wozniak, co-founder, Apple Computer. Introduction. I thought if there was just one computer in every school, some of the kids would find it. It would change their life. Steve Jobs. When I was growing up in the 1950s, the school curriculum focused entirely on memorization. The work we did was not relevant, creative, collaborative, or challenging, but rather the simple consumption of information requiring little more than short-term recall. Things were either black or white. We either memorized the material or we didn't. And it was understood that the seemingly never-ending series of standardized tests we were given would show how smart we were, in the process judging us, labeling us, sorting us, and attempting to forecast our future. Today, when I speak, I often reference the inspiring Army slogan that once prompted us to be all you can be. The slogan of a great educational system should be the same. An education should make us feel that we can do anything we set our minds to, and nothing can stop us. But for many of us sitting there at our desks, staring down at those omnipotent tests, that just wasn't the case. We were warned that these tests meant everything, and would define us in the eyes of our teachers, families, friends, and future employers. Even then, watching many of my fellow students struggle with those tests, I knew there was something inherently wrong with the way things were. Scores on a test had led many of us to believe that perhaps we already were all that we could be. I had always considered myself a good student. My parents read to me nightly, instilling a love of learning and discovery. I started reading young and was well prepared by the time I entered school. I absolutely loved those early grades, as they were more about discovering new things and just trying to learn how the world worked. Of course, we still had to learn the basics like arithmetic and spelling, but even those seemed interesting because my teachers made them fun and memorable. If this was what school was like, I thought, then I was going to love it. Then I entered middle school, and everything changed. Suddenly, school felt a lot less like fun and a lot more like work. It was as if our natural creativity, which comes from simply being a child, was no longer valued or wanted. Whereas in elementary school, we were these young, energetic, crazy ones, by the time we hit middle school, it was expected that we would be over our craziness, that we would grow up and become better at fitting in. Explorations have been replaced by expectations, collaborating by competing, discovering by memorizing. And the praise we had always gotten for how unique we were now came only when we received good grades and high test scores. If we did things differently in elementary school, it was considered creative. But when we did the same things in middle school, it was considered coloring outside the lines. Learning felt no longer rewarding, but boring, and it began to show in my work. I knew that I needed to adapt, so I quickly learned to play what I refer to as the education game, one complete with points, GPA, scores, grades, levels, grade levels, winning, graduating, and losing, dropping out. The character I became to play this education game was a memorizer. Even though it was not my strength, it didn't require too much work, and it seemed to be the way to win the game. The more I memorized, the better my grades got, and the more I was respected and appreciated by adults. Unfortunately, I also noticed that some of my friends just weren't very good at playing this game. To me, this made no sense, because I knew these were smart, creative kids who had thrived right along with me in elementary school. What was happening, I would wonder. The books and worksheets in middle school seemed pretty straightforward to me. How can such smart kids be losing? It seemed as if the education game was rigged against them. The wrong game. When I graduated from high school, a classmate wrote in my yearbook, "Aristotle and couch are now synonymous. Keep memorizing those problems." It was meant as a compliment, but looking back, it really captures the main weakness of our current educational system. A focus on learning what to think rather than how to think. In middle and high school, the rules of the education game were: take lecture notes, read the chapters, answer the questions, memorize the facts, and fill in the blanks on the tests. Then, based on our scores, we were rewarded with memberships in the National Honor Society, college acceptances and scholarships, and so on. By the time I graduated, I had the game all figured out. Or so I thought. I first attended college at the University of California, Riverside, where my memorizing evolved into cramming before exams. I made it through those so-called foundational courses in my freshman and sophomore years, playing the same game I played in high school, and it seemed to be working. But then in my junior year, one of my physics classes suddenly changed the game. The final exam consisted of a single question: describe the motion of a spinning top in free space. It represented a daunting challenge, because the professor had never directly addressed the problem in any lecture, nor had the textbook covered it. I could hear sounds of bewilderment, frustration, and mounting panic all around the lecture hall as my classmates read the question. One student didn't even try to search his brain for an answer. He just dropped his exam and textbook into the trash and walked out. The class erupted in ovation. But I didn't clap, because I was still staring down at that question in stunned silence. I had no idea what to write. If an answer couldn't be memorized, I was lost. That exam question was life-changing. I realized that trying to memorize my way through the rest of college and through life was not going to work. I realized education is not about memorizing, it's about learning how to think. And not a single book I had read had shown me how to do that. I had been playing the right game to succeed in the short term, but the rules I'd been playing by were totally useless for both this new game and for real life, which is the game school should have been preparing me for all along. Later that school year, I took a horticulture course that was equally as profound in shifting my understanding of learning, not to mention my career goals. I signed up for it solely because horticulture was one of the few departments that could afford an IBM computer and offered a course on computer programming. I was fascinated by the challenge of programming and the fact that there was never just one right answer. To pass this course, just like that physics exam with the spinning top, I couldn't just memorize my way through. What was required to succeed was logic and visualization, the type of thinking that leads to discovery. Some of my fellow students found the course difficult and frustrating, but I found it engaging and challenging. More important, that course was how I came to understand that for learning to be truly effective, it must be based on the process of problem solving. It was during that horticulture course that I fell in love with computers and their seemingly unlimited potential. I made up my mind that no matter what path my life eventually took, computers would play a significant role in it. However, since UC Riverside didn't offer an undergraduate degree in computer science, I needed to transfer to a different university. Despite the old African proverb, "Never test the depth of the water with both feet," I wanted to do just that with my newfound interest. I began searching for a college that offered an undergraduate degree in computer science and found one at the Berkeley campus of the University of California, where I earned a bachelor's and a master's degree and went on to enter their computer science PhD program. Studying computer science excited me. Every time I was on a computer, it made me feel empowered and in control, the way one might feel if they were suddenly freed from captivity. I felt that I could do anything, that I could once again be all that I could be. It felt as if doors had magically opened, exposing an entire world that I hadn't previously known existed. I was Alice getting her first look at Wonderland. In 1972, I accepted a job with Hewlett-Packard, HP, one of the biggest and most respected technology companies in the world. I felt like I was doing important work at the time, but several years later I received a phone call telling me about this small company led by a guy with a big vision. One that would change my life forever. A mental bicycle. "I want you to meet Steve Jobs," he said. "Who?" I asked. "He's the founder of Apple Computer." It was a clear, sunny day in the summer of 1978 when I received this call from my former supervisor at HP, Dr. Tom Whitney, who had recently become vice president of engineering at the up-and-coming tech startup called Apple Computer. I had been a computer programmer and software manager at HP for 5 years, but had barely heard of Apple and wasn't quite sure why Tom was inviting me to his house in Los Altos to meet its founder. "Okay," I told Tom. "I'll drop by." Of course, I had no idea as I hung up that phone that I would soon embark upon an extraordinary ride that would change my life and take me places I couldn't even imagine. Meeting Steve Jobs for the first time was quite an experience. He was a bit eccentric and more passionate about his vision for the future than anyone I had ever met. He spoke of things that didn't exist yet as if they were foregone conclusions, and championed the so-called personal computer as the invention with the potential to make it all happen. Coming from the world of mainframe and mini computers, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it all, but Steve sure did make it sound exciting. During that first meeting, I came to understand that Steve's expertise was in hardware, and he was looking for someone with expertise in software, which is what led him to me. He shared a research study profiled in the magazine Scientific American that had explored which animal uses the least amount of energy to move over a given distance. "The condor won," Steve said. "Humans didn't do as well. We're about a third of the way down the list." Then the twist. The test was run again, but this time the human was placed on a bicycle. How efficient would a human be if they covered that same distance riding a bicycle? Steve grew excited telling me about it. "The man on the bicycle blew the condor away," he said. "That's what the personal computer can be. A mental bicycle. It's the most remarkable tool in all of history." Steve saw technology as an amplifier for our intellect in the same manner that a bicycle amplifies our physical ability. Not only would it take us faster and more efficiently to where we've already been, but it would also allow us to go beyond, to discover, create, and innovate like never before. As a graduate student in the 1960s, I had witnessed firsthand the social revolution that took place in the streets, at People's Park in Berkeley, and all around the Bay Area. But as Steve saw it, the true social revolution that would empower people would be technology. Soon after that first meeting, Steve asked me to come down to Apple's office at Bandley One in Cupertino, where he offered me a job. I was a bit skeptical. At HP, we were building large computers that sold for $250,000, while Apple was building small personal computers that sold for $2,500, and Apple's salaries were capped at $40,000, because Steve wanted people who shared his vision and didn't just see Apple as a financial opportunity. Even though that was only a fraction of what I was earning at HP, I had to admit that this new world of personal computers was intriguing. I told Steve I'd consider the offer and went back to my office at HP, but it didn't take long for me to see just how persistent he could be. That Friday night, I was at home with my family when the doorbell rang. I answered and saw Steve standing there with a box in his hand, smiling. "Hi, John," he said. "Ready to change the world?" Once inside, Steve opened his box and placed an Apple II on our kitchen table in front of my 3-year-old son, Christopher. He proceeded to show him how it worked, and Chris instantly became immersed in it. "You know what, Chris?" Steve told him. "If your dad comes to work for me, you can keep this." All I could do was laugh. Steve and I continued to talk about the potential of technology, computers, and his far-reaching vision for the future. By the time he left, I too was starting to believe in its seemingly unlimited potential. But it was watching Chris's behavior over the weekend as he rode the Apple II that had the biggest impact on me. My son was glued to the personal computer, so much so that he had stopped watching TV altogether and instead explored and created things that I didn't think a 3-year-old could do. Most important, he was happily learning things, not because his teachers or parents required it, but because he wanted to. I could see Steve's vision of the future through the glow on my own son's face. On Sunday, I told Chris not to get too attached to the computer, because if I didn't take the job, it would have to be returned, and I was not sure I could accept the offer. "It's easy, Daddy," Chris told me. "Just say yes." The following week, I left HP and became employee 54 at Apple, working directly with Steve Jobs. Over the next several decades, I was fortunate enough to have had a front-row seat as computer-based technology became a part of kids' lives all over the world. As for Chris, the technology bug never did leave him. By high school, he was a virtual whiz who could already program, design, and write, and he produced a digital interactive presentation at the California High School History Fair that blew the judges away. He went on to graduate from the University of Pennsylvania in computer science, and his first job was on the team that designed eBay's website. In short, my son became the first of a new generation of digital natives, people for whom technology is viewed not as a tool, but as an environment for exploration. Chapter 1. Rewiring. If we teach today as we taught yesterday, we rob our children of tomorrow. John Dewey. The term digital native was introduced in a paper written by entrepreneur and author Mark Prensky in 2001 and is generally applied to anyone born after 1979. It describes those in the first generation to grow up in a digital world of personal computers, electronic games, tablets, and eventually cell phones. Today's high school students, for example, were born after the launch of Google and have never even known a world without the internet. They may have never used a library card catalog, or even a library card, choosing instead to rely on instantaneous web-based sources like search engines, Wikipedia, or YouTube for answers. New graduates were still elementary students when the original iPhone was introduced in 2007. Today, 4 out of 5 seventh graders have their own cell phones and are using a wealth of content and apps that are available to them 24/7. The importance of this change is not just about the power of the devices, but about the platforms and ecosystems that bring the devices to life. Some refer to the digital natives growing up today as the app generation. While I often hear adults refer to modern technology as a tool, digital natives see it as just a part of their environment, no different than how my generation perceived technologies like electricity. As a child, I didn't use electricity. Electricity just existed. Because of this, Prensky says, digital natives think and process information in a fundamentally different way than their predecessors. Many cognitive neuroscientists disagree, arguing instead that all brains process information differently, regardless of generation. However, there's no denying that the sheer amount of information that digital natives are exposed to via technology has greatly intensified both the number of changes occurring in the brain and the speed of which these changes are taking place. The truth is that today's kids have the ability to discover and learn more from a single mobile app than they ever could from any textbook ever written. One of the biggest problems facing education, says Prensky, is that teachers are speaking an outdated, pre-digital language and are struggling to teach a population that speaks almost entirely digital. The current educational system was designed to teach a very different set of children in a very different world with very different needs. The next big thing. Today, we live in a world of rapid technological innovation, where seemingly every day a new startup comes out of nowhere with a new invention that changes things. Overflowing with creativity and empowered by the latest technologies, these visionaries from around the world have disrupted status quos, revised inefficient designs, upgraded outdated systems, and reshaped entire industries. Except for one. Education. There have been no revolutionary changes to our education system in the past century. Even where local successes at the school and classroom level show promise, nothing new ever seems to scale. Take the story of one ambitious inventor who already had several successful inventions under his belt when he turned his attention to education reform. Like many of us, he found textbooks and lectures boring and believed that there had to be a better way to teach kids. He realized that our system was short-circuiting and needed rewiring. He went on to invent something that used the most advanced technology in existence and was unlike anything we had seen before. The inventor, and subsequently the media, loved it, declaring it something that would revolutionize education forever. Boring textbooks would now become a thing of the past. All students would now be able to learn equally, and our traditional classrooms, with their road desks, school bells, and a single teacher lecturing from the front of the class, would soon vanish forever. That invention was called an educational film, and was created by a guy named Thomas Edison in 1911. Over a century later, it's evident that Edison's invention didn't work out too well, as not much has changed in our schools or classrooms. But how could that have happened? Edison had already succeeded at changing the world with his phonograph in 1877, the light bulb in 1879, and the motion picture camera in 1891. Yet, he couldn't make a dent in education. If one of the greatest inventors of all time couldn't overcome the obstacles blocking education reform, what hope do we have of overcoming them today? What's changed? It may help to explore first what went wrong with Edison's educational film idea. It turns out, a group of intellectuals predicted the invention's failure, most notably a psychologist named John Dewey, who argued that it was more novel than practical, because he noted that kids learn best through hands-on interactive learning, where they are actually doing things. Dewey believed that sitting and watching content being taught to you on film was no different than sitting and watching content being taught to you in person. He argued that real learning was a social and interactive process that requires active participation, not passive observation. Since Edison's educational flop, hundreds of visionaries, innovators, and education reformers have followed his lead by introducing their own versions of the next big thing. And one by one, just like Edison's, each one failed. The reason? Dewey was right. Moving boring content from one medium to another doesn't make it any less boring and doesn't improve learning. As much potential as technology has to improve education, unless it's used as a means to integrate proven methods of learning and empower teachers to better deliver this learning, it is doomed to fail. To ensure the future of education that we want, at the scale that we want, technology and learning must be integrated. What's encouraging is that current and emerging innovations are indeed beginning to integrate the two, and the future looks bright, just like the light bulb, Edison's real game-changing invention. But change is needed to make that work. Now, As Apple's longtime vice president of education, a father of four, and a grandfather of 16, I have been blessed with the
sample complete. Ready to continue?